Let's continue on in the text where we left off. We've got a fair amount of things to cover this afternoon. So we're on page 3. We're in, the Vaibhashika section of the text. And we're in the 5th outline currently, the way of asserting object possessors. So we've just covered now the Vaibhashika assertion about what is really the person, what is the illustration of the person, and we saw a number of different assertions there. So we'll continue on from there. The next sentence says, there are two types of awareness, valid cognition and non-valid cognition. There's in this text and the other tenets text I have here, there's no description of how they define these types of awareness, because what we're going to see in the next school, the Sautrantika school, there is a very elaborate definitions of all these different types of awareness, and that's really based on Dharmakirti's work from the 7th century. Of course, Vaibhashika evolved much earlier than that, so how Vaibhashika actually define valid cognition and valid perception and so forth is not so sure. So we'll leave the definitions of those for the next school, Sautrantika. And what we're going to see shortly anyway, there are some differences, particularly in terms of when we talk about sense perception between Vaibhashika and the other schools. So for now, let's just understand that according to Vaibhashika, there are two types of awareness or mind, a valid cognition and one that's not valid. And within valid cognition, there are two types of valid cognition, valid perception and valid inference. And this comes from what? Because there are different types of phenomena to be known. It's often said there are three types of phenomena. There is what's called manifest phenomena, and a manifest phenomena is something that can be directly known. So that would relate to what's called here valid perception. So valid perception is when we can directly know something. And then we have two other types of phenomena. There's what's called slightly hidden phenomena, and that's something that we can't directly know, but that we can know through reasoning. And the classic example that's often used here in the text is on the distant mountain you see some smoke arising, and on the basis of that sign or that reason of seeing the smoke, you can infer correctly the existence of fire. So even though you can't directly see, the fire is not manifest, we can't see it, we can establish its existence through inference, through reasoning. So that's called a slightly hidden phenomena. So a slightly hidden phenomena can be known through inference, valid inference. But then we also have extremely hidden phenomena, and an extremely hidden phenomena is something that cannot be even established to exist through reasoning and logic. And often the example that's given here, and we'll see this actually in the next section of the Sautrantika section regarding this, is what's called the subtle workings of karma, the fact of this particular action giving rise to this experience, that only an enlightened person can see that, can know that. So this type of phenomena can only be established through what's called authority, that a valid person, because they have directly seen this and they report this, then we can know it through authority.
And so this is also considered to be a type of inference through authority. In fact, if we look in our scientific understanding, a lot of our own scientific understanding is this, isn't it? I mean, have we, for example, ever seen an atom? No. Can we, using our ability, infer their existence? No. Have they been established to be exist? Yes, validly through doing various experiments. But even a scientist, has any scientist ever seen an atom? No. All they do is run valid experiments and they see data, like the smoke, that would validly establish the existence of atoms and subatomic particles. Like, for example, the famous one recently, the Higgs boson, that they established the existence of. I mean, no one ever saw a Higgs boson, but they ran an experiment based actually on mathematics from much earlier, mathematically through inference that they came to understand existence. And then they received evidence. Through using that evidence, then they can infer that that fact exists. For us, of course, it's extremely hidden because we don't have that ability to do that inference. I mean, if we studied a lot of mathematics and we had a lot of scientific knowledge and we ran the experiment, then we could establish it ourselves. But for us, a lot of our scientific knowledge is in this category because we just accept that authority, that we accept that these people, these scientists, are valid persons, that they have done the correct experiment to validly establish. But for us, it's an extremely hidden phenomenon. So these two, this one we can know from direct perception, and these two are from valid inference, either through reasoning and logic or through authority. So these are the two types of valid cognition that I mentioned here. And then within valid perception, meaning there are three ways in which we can know directly. Sense perception. So sense perception, of course, is through the senses. And so our senses, of course, directly know their objects. So sense perception is that visually our eye consciousness directly establishes the existence of the flower. Then we also have mental perception and yogic perception. But before we go on to that, I just want to add a little bit on the sense perception, because here the Vaibhashikas have a little bit of a different assertion that no other Buddhist philosophical school accepts. And that is the sentence below there. It says, a valid sense perception is not necessarily a consciousness because an eye sense power is a valid perception. So what is an eye sense power? In general, for a consciousness to arise, we need three conditions. That we need what's called an observed object condition, we need an empowering condition, and an immediately preceding condition. So here, when we're talking about a valid perception visually, normally what we require, of course, is an object. The empowering condition is the eye sense power. And the immediately preceding condition is an immediately preceding moment of consciousness. So if those three things come together, then we can have a consciousness generated observing the object. Now, this empowering condition here, the I sense power, is where the Vaibhashikas have a different assertion, because they say this I sense power, the I faculty, is a valid sense conscious, a valid sense perception. Of course, no other school would accept that. And on that point, we have on in here a little bit more about that. It says the following on page 157. It says, they assert valid cognition, that is, physical sense powers, and there's a little footnote for that, which says, the sense power itself apprehends things, not just the consciousness that use the sense powers. They argue that since the eye consciousness, for instance, is not matter, it should be unobstructed by walls, etc. Therefore, matter must be involved in the process of cognition, limiting what can be perceived. So part of their argument here is that the eye consciousness, because it's not matter, shouldn't be obstructed by matter. So therefore, we should be able to see things on the other side of the wall. That's their sort of argument. So they're saying that because the eye faculty is material, that's involved in cognition, that's why we can't see other things, things on the other side of the wall. So for them, they would accept that the eye sense power, the eye faculty, is a valid perception. And as part of that, they assert that the eye sense power contacts the object directly, nakedly. And I think that's a little bit related to what in some modern philosophies we talk about naive realism, and which I think hardly anyone accepts anymore. The idea that we observe the physical phenomena directly as they are. Whereas in the Sautrantika and all the other Buddhist schools, we talk about that the faculty takes on an aspect of the object, its aspected perception, which is more commonly accepted in I think, modern philosophy as well. So this is something a little bit different with the Vaibhashikas, as they accept that the eye sense power, the eye faculty, is a valid perception, whereas no other school would accept that. Okay, any question about that? I mean, it's a little bit, I can sort of understand the logic, but still, it doesn't make so much sense to me. Sorry? Yeah, like there's no other Buddhist school that would, philosophical school that accepts that. It's only the Vaibhashikas. Okay. So then there's mental perception and yogic perception. So what's the difference between mental... Yeah. Again, I don't... There's not really anything here to talk that talks about that. So I don't want to put words in their mouth. So we'll leave it out. Because I was looking in these texts for more information about how they define these things, but I couldn't find any. And all the what you're talking about, that was all really came developed particularly through Dharmakirti in the 7th century, so we're talking many centuries later. Possibly. Okay. Yeah, and that's actually going to come up shortly, a little bit later this afternoon, is that we need to, there's a difference between accepting a tenet and practicing a path. So even though, for example, in the Tibetan Buddhist systems, the tenet system that they follow is Prasangika. But an individual who's practicing the path
may not be at that level of understanding. So they actually may be in their own experience following this, in terms of their actual experience. So when you ask that question, we need to make that distinguishment between an actual tenet system versus the person who's practicing the path. So even though, like I said, in all Buddhist traditions, the tenet system is prasangika, what the person who's practicing Tibetan Buddhism is actually holding and experiencing may not be that. Yeah, because that's a very profound tenet. So we may not be at that level, even though that's the tenet system that is used mainly. So that's, we need to be careful. But what I'm saying is that generally, these two first tenet systems are coming within the Four Noble Truths teachings. And so that is the basis of the Pali traditions, which are normally now called Theravada traditions. So I think if you look at the tenet systems within there, they will be somewhat similar to what some of these here and in Sautrantika. Now, whether or not then the person who's practicing within the Theravada tradition has that experience understanding, that's a completely different matter. And from the Prasangika perspective, anyway, regardless of whatever tenet system you begin with, you will end up with the Prasangika view in terms of your practice, if you go deep enough. So we need to make that distinguishment. Sure. But each lower school also refutes the higher school through logic. Well, I don't know. I think that's why it's important. See, that's why it's important to really study these tenet systems, because superficially, it may seem that some of these systems we're looking at now, I'm beyond that. But actually, if we look at what we're actually holding on to in our experience, it's probably something even less profound than this. Because aren't we, in our experience, grasping onto things being very stable, aren't we? I think we all are. Vaibhashika do not assert that. So the Vaibhashika view is superior to our current experience, isn't it? Because we are grasping onto things as being stable and static. And also, as we're going to see shortly, in terms of selflessness, we are grasping onto a substantial me, which Vaibhashika refute. So in terms of person, their view is superior to our experience now. So we need to be careful not to just look at that and go, Vaibhashika, I'm better than that. Experientially, we're not. We're worse. We're grasping at things much more coarse than the Vaibhashika are asserting. So we need to be... Otherwise, we can look at these and go, I'm a Prasangika, you know. Those views are inferior. And then we've really missed the point altogether. Sure.
Yeah, a little bit like that, because here, what falls into those categories depends on us. I mean, if we really come to realize some of these, then for us, they become manifest. And even this, for us, eventually will become a manifest phenomenon. So it depends on our level, of course. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah, so a mental perception, so perception again is direct, non-conceptual. Generally for us, an ordinary person, apart from the fact of if we have, you know, things like clairvoyance and so forth are considered mental perception. We are directly like knowing someone's mind or directly seeing some distant object or directly seeing our past lives. That is a type of mental perception. But assuming we don't have those capacities, then for a normal person, the only really time we have a mental perception, non-conceptual, direct, is it said that when we're observing some sense object, let's say we're looking at this flower, so our visual consciousness is a direct perception, a sense perception of that flower. But then, of course, based on that, then our mental consciousness conceptually then would interpret that and know a flower conceptually through a concept. But it's said that the very first moment of that is still direct, but of course we don't ascertain it. So it's said that it's only at the end of that sense perception, the very first moment of mental perception is direct, but then we interpret that data and understand the flower conceptually. Whereas yogic perception is a perception, a mental perception that is generated through the power of meditation. And here we'll actually borrow on the Saltrantika definition of yogic perception to understand a little bit. So this is a few pages over on page 8 down the bottom. So a yogic perception, according to Saltrantika, is an exalted wisdom that directly realizes subtle impermanence or either coarse and subtle selfness as a person, in dependence upon a meditative stabilization that is a union of shamatha and vipassana, its own uncommon empowering condition. So I'm not 100% certain that Vaibhashika would define it in exactly the same way, but certainly also for Vaibhashika, a yogic perception would be one that is generated through this union of shamatha and vipassana, through meditation, that on the basis of single point and concentration, we enter into vipassana practice and either, in this case, are directly realizing impermanence or directly realizing selfness as a person. And that mind, of course, we are directly realizing that impermanence and selfness as a person. So this is called a yogic perception, direct perception. And we see that down the bottom of page 3. It says there are two types of yogic perception. Yogic perception that directly realizes selfness as a person and yogic perception that directly realizes subtle impermanence. And then if we go over onto the next page, it talks about the yogic perception that directly realizes selfness as a person. And here it talks about two types of realization of selfness as a person. And to talk about that, we can actually use, there's a chart you have, coarse and subtle selflessness, if you want to go to that page. So we can talk about this selflessness of person at two levels, coarse and subtle.
And as we've already previously seen, at the time of the Buddha, a number of non-Buddhist systems, when we talk about illustration of person, were in fact accepting this, that the person that goes from life to life and achieves liberation is a person that is unchanging, unitary, and independent. This idea of self or person would imply, as we saw, a self or person that is completely independent of the body and the mind. And from a Buddhist perspective, this idea of person or self is not something that we instinctively have. We don't instinctively have this false sense of me, because this would imply having a sense of me somewhere over there, meaning a sense of me completely independent of body and mind. And from a Buddhist perspective, we only have a sense of me or person with respect to some aspect of the body and the mind. So they would say that this idea of personal self is something that can only be generated through some wrong way of contemplating and thinking. So often in Buddhism we call this an intellectually acquired conception of self. And so therefore it's very coarse, it's a very coarse idea of self, of person. But here there is another idea of self that we do instinctively have, this idea of self-sufficient, substantially existent self. This sense of personal self is something that we have within the context of the body and the mind. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is something we instinctively have. We're grasping onto ourself existing in this way. And this idea of me, person, is something that's also reflected in our language, the way we speak and think. For example, we often say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's a third thing, a me, that is stands apart from the body and the mind, that has a body and has a mind. So in the way we speak, there seems to be three things: body, mind, and me. A me that is the possessor of the body and the mind. Also, we have a sense, you know, that within that, there's also a sense that this me that sort of it's somewhere here, it's not over there. It seems to be somewhere here, but it stands apart. It's like often the analogy given here is like it's the master or controller of the body and the mind. And also we have a sense that this me is the continuity. Because also in our language we say, when I was young, I did this last week, I'm going to do this next week, as if there's this common me that goes through that. Of course, we understand our body and our mind. When I was young, my body was completely different. My mind was probably completely different. And next week, my body's going to be changed in that. But somehow, within that, there seems to be this entity that is the thread in all of those changes of body and mind. Seems to be this me. When I was young, I'm going to do this next year, next month. So there seems to be some commonality there, this me. And this is how it appears to us and we hold on to it. Also, with regard to this, sometimes we look at our body, we don't like what we see, and then sometimes we even have a thought, I wish I could swap this body for a more younger, more healthy, more beautiful body. You know, sometimes we have this thought. And then we look at the state of our mind and it's a big mess. And sometimes we even have the thought, oh, I'd like to swap this mind for a more intelligent, quieter, loving, kind mind. But where is the me that could do the swap? Because that's how we think. If we take away this body and mind, where's the me that could do the swap? Is there anything more than the body and the mind here? Is there a third thing, an extra thing, a me? Again, if we look at it simply, intellectually, I think it's not too difficult to understand there's nothing in addition to the body and the mind. So, but experientially, that's how we behave. Experientially, we are definitely grasping onto and identifying ourselves in this way. And so this is what's called the subtle conception of self of person, is we grasp onto our self existing in this self-sufficient, substantially existent way. Self-sufficient, of course, means not seeming to rely on anything else to exist, and substantial in the same way, not needing anything else to appear for it to exist. So that's how we actually instinctively see ourselves as a person. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is a false sense of me. This is a superimposition that the person is nothing more than being merely labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. And so here, the Vaibhashikas, and in fact, if you look at this Course in Subtle Selflessness chart, if you look at all the subsequent schools, the Sautrantika, Chittamatra, and also the Svatantrika part of Majjhamika, they all say the same thing. That the coarse conception of self is this, the subtle conception of self is this, and that if we get rid of this, we can actually achieve liberation from samsara. Because all schools, except Prasangika, say this is the fundamental ignorance that is stopping us or keeping us in samsara. If we get rid of this, realizing no such self, we can achieve nirvana. But if we look in this chart at Prasangika, they disagree. They would say this is coarse, but it's so coarse we don't even need to worry about it. Rather, they would say this is quite coarse because there is a more subtle grasping onto self than this. And that is grasping onto self being inherently existent. So they say that for self or person, there's a third way of mistaking. So for Prasangika, of course they'd say this is coarse, but the coarse one that we do instinctively have is this. And the subtle is this. And so we see that in the Prasangika assertion there. Again, all lower schools than Prasangika say, in fact, the person does inherently exist. So they say that's not a problem, that there is an inherently existent self, me, person. It's only Prasangika that refutes this. Any questions on this?
Point three.
So all the difference, so this, no Buddhist school accepts this. So all Buddhist schools say that doesn't exist. Some non-Buddhist schools at the time of Buddha accepted that exists, but all of them refute it. And all of the Buddhist schools also refute this, although there is one sort of variation that we're going to look at shortly. But in general, all Buddhist schools also refute this. This doesn't exist. And for most Buddhist schools, if we realize that doesn't exist, we can achieve nirvana. Prasangika also saying that doesn't exist, and if you realize that, good. Probably if you realize that, you're going to reduce your attachment and aversion. Very good. but you're not going to get out of samsara. Because prasangikas say that there's a more subtle level of ignorance operating, that we're grasping onto an inherently existent me. And so for prasangika, if we want to achieve liberation, we need to realize that doesn't exist. There's no inherently existent me. No. See, the difference being here is that this is saying that there's something more than the body and the mind here. There's something extra. There's something extra. There's a third thing more than the body and the mind. And so for the lower schools, you can get rid of that. And at the same time, grasp onto inherently existent body and mind. And same with prasangika. They say you can get rid of this and still grasp onto inherently existent body and mind, but then you're still stuck. Yeah, because things exist. For all the lower schools, for something to exist, it must inherently exist. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. Yes, but for prasangika, independent is synonymous with this.
Yes, but what to do, for example, mind-changing goal, like Chittamatran say?
Sorry?
What do, for example, Chittamatran say?
Same.
Mind basis of all. But they say that it doesn't depend on anything?
The mind basis of all inherently exists for Chittamatran. It truly exists.
True, but how do they define true exists?
The same, existing independently.
So they say that there is something, subtle mind, subtle consciousness.
But remember here, we're talking about person. So for Chittamatra, as we see in this chart, they also refute this.
Yes.
So for Chittamatra, if you realize there's no substantially existent self, you achieve nirvana in the Chittamatra.
Yes. But they still say that there is something in the person. Mind based on wall or something that
exactly.
Is independent.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in fact, if we look back at there, if we look back at one of the original charts, the classification of tenet systems, and we look at Chittamatra, it says they adhere to the true existence of the internal mind. Okay. So mind basis of all, of course, is part of the mind. So mind basis of all for Chittamatra truly exists.
How can they subscribe to the view that all phenomena is empty in the forces? How?
Because for them, it means empty of being external.
I see. Okay.
So they also, when they talk about emptiness, they often talk about non-duality.
Okay.
No external phenomena. That's for them emptiness. It's defined a couple of ways, which we're going to look at next weekend, but that's the simple answer. Well, so say again? Would reject all three.
So if they cannot realize that there's the second one, yeah, let's say if they realize that there's not, then what would they be in terms of that?
Nowhere. You would, as I mentioned, if you really realize this, a lot of attachment and aversion would be reduced because a lot of our attachment and aversion is based on this. So if you realize this, it's going to be very good. But in terms of the actual progression on the path, we're nowhere. Similarly, here in the Vaibhashika, this yogic perception in Vaibhashika and Satrantika, part of it is realizing subtle impermanence. From a prasangika perspective, if we realize subtle impermanence with respect to person or anything, we're this close to realizing emptiness. Because if you understand through experience what impermanence really means, for Prasangika, it's synonymous with emptiness. For example, you know, when we talk about impermanence and the way it's described, things changing moment by moment, so then we go, oh yeah, I know what that means. We have the present moment, there's a thing here in the present moment, and in the next moment, it changes into something else, which in the next moment changes into something else. Is this subtle impermanence?
No.
No, it's not, is it? Because if this is our idea, it's illogical. And scientifically, that's not the way it is. Scientifically, it's not that what's going on, it's this, isn't it? Isn't there just a constant flow of change? Because if we're saying that the present moment has a thing, we're saying there's something that exists for a very short time, not changing. That's not correct. So if we understand subtle impermanence, meaning not this but this, just continuous flow of change, then how can there be something that exists from its own side? It can't. So for Prasangika, if we have this yogic perception of subtle impermanence, we're this close to realizing emptiness. But of course, the lower schools also accept subtle impermanence, but they say they have no problem accepting that and accepting this, that things exist from that. They see no contradiction. Correct. Right. Yeah, and all Buddhist schools, including Prasangika, say the same thing with respect to person. Person is something labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. What that implies is different. For Prasangika, it implies, therefore, the body and the mind and the person can't inherently exist. For the lower schools, the body and mind and person must inherently exist. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist at all. Because for all the lower schools, for something to exist, it must be findable amongst the bases. You can find, because the body is the collection of the parts, the mind is the collection of the parts, and the person is labelled on those collections. Yeah. So again, the real dividing line here between Prasangika and everyone below is that point. For everyone below, if you can't find it, it doesn't exist. For Prasangika, it can only exist if it's not findable. What that really means, we're going to talk about next weekend. And so that's really the crux of this here. So for all lower schools, if things didn't inherently exist, they don't exist at all. Okay. Sure. Yeah. So again, of course, all Buddhist schools accept dependent arising, but what they accept and how they interpret differs. So of course, Vaibhashika assert things depend on causes and conditions. And also Sautrantika, all the schools accept that, and they depend on parts.
But then when we come to in terms of things being dependent on imputation or labeling, that's really only the Majjhimika, particularly Prasangika, who accept that. Okay. So let's go now on page 4 into the next section, the way of asserting selflessness. Subtle selflessnesses and selflessnesses of person are accepted to be equivalent. A selfness as a phenomenon is not asserted because it is asserted as if it is an established base, it is necessarily a self of phenomena. And so we can see that in that coarse and subtle selflessnesses chart that in the Vaibhashika that we only talk about selflessnesses of person because phenomena exist as they appear. They truly exist. So if it is an established base, it's necessarily a self of phenomena. So self of phenomena here just really means truly existent, existing inherently. So they, again, say there's no problem with the way we see the world. The only problem is with the way with respect to which we see ourselves as a person. But then now here there's one little sort of group within Vaibhashika who have this sort of slightly obscure assertion. In the next paragraph it says, among them, the Vatsiputra followers, so this is one of these 18 sub-schools, assert a selflessness of phenomena, that is a person being empty of being permanent, unitary and independent. So as with all Buddhist schools, they accept that. However, they do not assert a selflessness of person, that is a person being empty of being self-sufficient, substantially existent, because they assert a self-sufficient, substantially existent self that is inexpressible, even in terms of being either one entity or different entity from the aggregates, or either being permanent or impermanent. Of course, according to the other Buddhist philosophical systems, even within Vaibhashika, they wouldn't accept that, and they would say that that assertion is actually asserting a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So there's even sometimes within these tenets texts talk that these people are not really Buddhists because they accept self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So that's only the one of the Vaibhashika sub-schools that have this obscure assertion, but what really that means is a bit difficult to appreciate, I think. So I don't think we really need to spend any much time on it. So let's now go to outline 7, and that is presentation of grounds and paths. So in outline 6, the way of asserting selflessness, what we've seen is that the fundamental ignorance, according to Vaibhashika, is this grasping onto self-sufficient, substantially existent self, the person. And that if we realize no self-sufficient, substantially existent me, we can traverse the path to liberation from samsara. So that's what the grounds and paths are about, is based on that, realizing that selflessness, then how can we progress along the spiritual path to liberation? So first in here we have the objects of abandonment. So what are we abandoning here? So we see here there are two types of obscurations, afflictive obscurations and non-afflictive obscurations. It says here, there is no such thing as the convention cognitive obscurations. So what we find, what we'll find next weekend is that in the Chittamatra and Majjhimika philosophical system, they make a clear distinction between the goal of nirvana and the goal of enlightenment, that they are actually sequential. So for them, what obscures us from achieving nirvana is what's called the afflictive obscuration. So all Buddhist schools accept that, that if we abandon these afflictive obscurations, we can achieve nirvana. But then in the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system, they say that there is actually a step then from nirvana to enlightenment, to becoming a Buddha, And to traverse that step, we need to overcome what's called the cognitive obscurations, because that's what's blocking us from moving from nirvana to enlightenment. What those cognitive obscurations are, of course, varies within Chittamatra and Madhyamika systems, but we'll look at that next weekend. Whereas here in the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, they don't really make a distinction between nirvana and enlightenment. And so therefore, for them, there's no such thing as cognitive obscurations. Rather, what they talk about are these non-afflictive obscurations, because also in these philosophical schools, they assert that the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, had some more ability than the average person who achieves nirvana. So they say that the Buddha eliminated these non-afflictive obscurations, whereas a person who achieves nirvana, what's called an arhat, hasn't eliminated these. So that's what they're talking about here. So afflictive obscurations mainly prevent attainment of liberation, and non-afflictive obscurations mainly prevent the attainment of all knowingness, which within this philosophical system, of course, they assert, except that the Buddha had this capacity of all knowingness. So then illustrations of these, it says, illustrations of afflictive obscurations are the conception apprehending the person to be self-sufficient, substantially existent, and the three poisons that arise due to the force of that conception together with their seeds. So as we've just now seen, all schools below Prasangika assert this, that the afflictive obscurations, what's stopping us from achieving liberation, from achieving nirvana, is this, the conception of self-sufficient, substantially existent self, plus all the mental afflictions. Here it focuses on the three poisons, but all the mental afflictions that arise due to that. So sometimes that's put into the afflictive obscurations as well. But the root is, of course, this conception of self-sufficient, substantially existent self. And then here in the Vaibhashika, they talk about this non-afflictive obscuration are the latencies of the conception apprehending a person to be self-sufficient, substantially existent, and the dysfunctional tendencies of the mind that arise due to the force of these latencies. So here we've seen there's two words, seeds and latencies. So a seed of a mental affliction or a seed of ignorance is like the habit, the predisposition. So the seed of a mental affliction gives rise to the mental affliction. So every time we have a mental affliction, we're strengthening that seed. So the seed produces the mental affliction. So the seed of anger, when it comes together with conditions, manifests as anger. Whereas the latency of a mental affliction is different. And here in the Vaibhashika, the latency, which is a side effect of the affliction, they say that this latency, what does it produce or cause? They say it produces this dysfunctional tendencies of the mind. What they are, I think I remember once in one text reading something about doing some sort of strange behavior. I think it was jumping around like a monkey or something. Something, I can't remember what it was. Whereas in the Prasangika, which we're going to see next weekend, they also talk about latencies of ignorance or mental afflictions. For them, what does the latency, also for Prasangika, the seed of a mental affliction causes the mental affliction. What does the latency of ignorance in Prasangika cause? It causes a mistaken dualistic appearance. So when they talk about latencies, what the latency produces is not the same as what Vaibhashika and Sautrantika accept. So keep that in mind. Yeah. So the latency for prasangika, the latency of ignorance for prasangika, here the latency is producing this dysfunctional tendency of the mind. For prasangika, the latency of ignorance is producing or causing mistaken dualistic appearance. But we'll look at that in more detail next weekend. So that is the objects of abandonment. Any questions? So every time we have ignorance or a mental affliction, that increases the seed. But also we have a side effect of ignorance as well. It's called latency. Latency of ignorance. And here in the Vaibhashika, that latency of ignorance doesn't produce ignorance. This latency of ignorance produces, as they say, some dysfunctional tendency of the mind. What that really means, I remember reading in one text that talked about doing some sort of strange behavior. But again, what in detail that means, I'm not sure. Dysfunctional tendency of the mind. It certainly doesn't mean that it creates mental afflictions or unethical behavior. That's certainly the case, that this dysfunctional tendency of the mind is not a mental affliction or unethical behavior, because an arhat has eliminated this and has gone beyond suffering and its causes. So an arhat still has this. And according to Vaibhashika, it causes this dysfunctional tendency of the mind, but that cannot mean a mental affliction or unethical behavior. What it actually means, again, I think once I saw something about doing some strange behavior of the body. More than that, I've not really seen in detail. For prasangika, also they talk about the same idea. And for prasangika, the latency of ignorance means that when we have that latency of ignorance, it's like a stain in the mind. When we come together with an object, when we perceive an object, and we have this latency of ignorance in the mind, that produces mistaken dualistic appearance. So for prasangika, you know, when we look out on the world appears to exist independent of us. And the prasangikas are saying it's not existing in that way. So the question then is, if things don't exist like that, why do they appear to exist in that way? And the assertion is, it's because of this. This is what's causing this mistaken dualistic appearance. So for prasangika, if this is the cognitive obscuration, the cognitive obscuration is these latencies and the mistaken and dualistic appearance that they produce. And so if we want to achieve enlightenment from a prasangika perspective, we need to get rid of this. But of course, no other school below them would accept this. Correct. Yes. Yes and no. I mean, of course, it's related to the two truths. Yeah, I mean, this is the brief answer, and we're jumping right ahead here. The brief answer, of course, is that what is stopping the bodhisattva from realizing the two truths simultaneously is, in fact, this. Is exactly that, yes. Any other last question? Otherwise, it's time for a tea break. I think we need tea break. Okay. Let's take a tea break, and then after the tea break, we'll come back and we'll look at the grounds and paths of Vaibhashika, and I think we should be able to finish off the Vaibhashika system this afternoon.